Water, Wisconsin, and the Mercury Cycle, a production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute, with funding provided by the United States Geological Survey. This is Chris Bocast for the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. Besides producing audio, I have a background in environmental history, so it made sense for me to be your guide, as it were, for the first two episodes in this series. Now it's the scientist's turn. In the previous two podcasts, we looked first at the history of humanity's relationship with mercury. Then we examined the history of water use in Wisconsin in order to emphasize the central importance of the hydrological cycle to human culture. We pick up where our historical narrative of mercury left off in the 1960s. At that time, it began to be recognized that the serious problems associated with mercury use would require significant scientific research to be able to comprehend and ameliorate this danger to human health. In this podcast, you will hear from some of the top scientists involved in this effort, speaking about their contributions to the work, the challenges they encountered, and their own understanding of the impact of mercury research as we head into the 21st century. In order of their appearance, you will hear from
Anders Andrén. I am professor of civil and environmental engineering and also director of the Segrin Institute and the Water Resources Institute at UW-Madison.
Dave Krabanoff. I'm a research scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey located in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Jim Hurley. I am assistant director for the University of Wisconsin Aquatic Sciences Center.
And
my name is Chris Babiarz. I work at the Water Science and Engineering Laboratory at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
These individuals are key players in the ongoing attempt to understand, curtail, and eventually eliminate the threat of mercury contamination. I found their knowledge and dedication to this work both informative and inspiring. And I hope that you will too in this episode, Mercury Mysteries, The Scientist's Tale.
We have a great story to tell with regard to a discovery of a problem that happened in the 1980s. We continue to make fundamental discoveries about how fast mercury is moving through our airways and what that means about potential recovery of ecosystems across the globe. We will continue to seek these discoveries and help our decision makers to make the most effective use of our knowledge and hopefully, in the end, reduce the amount of exposure to mankind globally. It doesn't take very much mercury to create a problem of global extent. And that, in fact, is one of the fundamental paradigms that all mercury researchers have to come to grips with eventually, and that is that this element, number 80 on the periodic table, is in fact very mercurial, meaning it goes everywhere, and it goes places very fast and very efficiently, and it also accumulates in locations very fast and at levels that can be very unsafe. And so it's a very interesting set of realizations that when we're doing our research, we have to ponder every once in a while. But it's all about the very unique characteristics of mercury being this only vaporous metal that we have on planet Earth.
While at Florida State University, we started working on mercury. This was in the late 60s when the United States really became aware of contaminants in the environment and specifically metals. The metals that really catalyzed and focused our interest in the environment were two. They were really mercury and lead. A lot of work had been done with lead, specifically risk assessment to children, but not very much had been done on mercury at the time. What were the real concentrations in water, in sediments, and in fish in the U.S. at this time? Nobody really knew. We had some reports from Scandinavia and from Japan, but we really didn't know what the concentrations were. What really happened was in those days, our analytical techniques were pretty poor. Work had been done in Sweden by a lady named Gunnel Wester, where she had developed a technique for measuring methyl mercury in fish. Now, very little of that had been done in the U.S. We were not aware of any work, as a matter of fact. So I had to spend the first 2 years in the lab developing methods to measure mercury in the environment. The last 2 years of my years there, what we did was every 6 weeks we got on a ship in New Orleans and sampled our way down the Mississippi River out into the Gulf of Mexico, where we followed the sediment plumes, oftentimes all the way down to the Campeche banks. Then we came back and spent the next several weeks in the lab analyzing for mercury in our water and sediment samples. This was in the late 60s, starting about 1968 to 70 when all this was done. Because of this, I adopted the technique that Gunnel Wester had used to measure methylmercury in fish to do the same thing in sediments. And we actually published the first methylmercury values for sediments in the world. It took me about 3 weeks to do about 5 or 6 samples. That's how difficult it was. From there on, I did a lot of determinations of mercury in the environment. And when I graduated from Florida State University, I got an opportunity to become a postdoc at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, which was one of the U.S. national labs. And what we did was spend a lot of time sampling the environment, and basically everybody became aware this time about how sloppy industries and researchers had been in the past by dumping just tons and tons of different chemicals in the environment. We began to catalog these, and mercury was just but one of the elements. After about 2 years at Oak Ridge, I was recruited to come to University of Wisconsin-Madison. We had so many questions about the behavior of the mercury, so we started actually determining physical chemical properties of different mercury compounds, just so we would do a better job of predicting how different mercury compounds would behave in the environment. At this time also, some of the original work that we did had been picked up by Bill Fitzgerald at University of Connecticut. We use what is called an atomic fluorescence method to determine mercury in different samples. And up to that time, most people had used atomic absorption. But we thought that atomic fluorescence would be infinitely more sensitive. And indeed it is, to the extent where with this particular technique you can actually determine concentration in water and air down to picograms or nanograms. Nanograms is 10 to the minus 9 gram, and picogram is 10 to the minus 12 gram. And 1 gram is 2.54 ounces. So you can imagine that we can determine mercury concentrations in anything. We can find it anywhere. We're just limited by Planck problems, since mercury is a natural compound in the Earth's crust and water and air. At this time then, the new technique came on board and mercury research exploded in the United States, I would say, in about the mid-80s, where a lot of labs were built. Our lab here at University of Wisconsin in the mid-80s was probably one of the first in the world to be able to measure a variety of different mercury compounds in air, in water, in sediment, and in biological matter, and could also differentiate between different chemical forms of mercury in the environment.
Prior to the early 1980s, there were only a few groups that were really analyzing trace metals well. They were the oceanographers. There was a study back in the early 70s by a researcher named Claire Patterson, and Patterson was looking at low levels of lead in the ocean. And what he found out, I think the title of his article, I don't have the exact wording for it, but it was on the reduction of, by orders of magnitude, the actual concentration of lead in environmental samples. And what Patterson at the time found out was that the sampling technique that he used was contaminating the sample for lead. This was what was known as the evolution of clean techniques in the oceanographic world. And what they found out is that instead of sampling anywhere near the hull of a ship in the middle of the ocean, they had to get away from that hull of that boat. They had to make sure there were non-metal sampling units that they were using. They had to use Teflon bottles. They had to acid clean the Teflon bottles. And by doing all of these steps along the way of sample preparation, and then also upping the sensitivity of the analytical technique of the instrument that measures lead, what they were finding is that the numbers that were being reported in the oceans were probably 2 to 3 orders of magnitude higher. Numbers that researchers were reporting using these new clean techniques were 1,000, 100, 10 times lower than anybody had reported before. So if you take numbers like that and you start extrapolating them to an overall global mass balance or trying to figure out arrows of how much comes in and how much leaves, even a small portion of the ocean, by reducing those numbers, you tend to come to some different conclusions about how trace metals are cycling in the oceans. This was a huge watershed moment in trace metal research, and that was realizing that even if we had sensitive techniques, if the sample wasn't prepared in the right way, you just couldn't interpret any sort of pathways of cycling.
One of the greatest challenges that we had early on in our research was the realization that almost all environmental data on the concentrations of mercury in lake water or streams or wetlands, any water sample analyzed before about 1988, the data is frankly inaccurate. It wasn't any purposeful errors being made by scientists. It simply was a lack of a realization that, in fact, there was more mercury already on the surface walls of the container that the water sample was going to go into than the water would have contained. And in fact, it wasn't just a little bit more, it was probably hundreds of times more mercury was already attached to the inside wall of the container than was going to be in the water sample that we would collect. And therefore, for decades, people were collecting samples unknowingly, with the resultant being that the concentrations in the water that the lab would report had actually nothing to do with how much mercury was in the water in the environment, but just happened to be how much mercury was on the inside walls of the container. And so there was a significant discovery then when we first started working on the problem, and that was the need for so-called clean techniques. And what we mean by that are sample handling, including our hands and the container we put the sample in and the kind of clothing we would wear, where we wouldn't actually jeopardize the sample with our sampling strategy or our sampling container, but instead actually get a sample that reflected the environmental condition. And it turns out that wasn't such a small challenge. We spent several years of working on this issue back in the 80s, simply doing that, proving that in fact the samples we were collecting reflected the environment and not our sampling technique.
So bring this to Wisconsin. There were people that were doing mercury research already in northern Wisconsin. Over a 5-year period, there was a comparison of different studies that were done on a single lake and what the concentrations were reported in that lake. With mercury now, with the new techniques, we start to report levels in nanograms per liter. And people in this one lake in northern Wisconsin had been reporting the concentrations of mercury in 1980 that they were a half a microgram per liter or 500 nanograms per liter. A couple years later, another group came by and said, no, they're actually 100 nanograms per liter. And the reason they know it is because they weren't using a metal sampler like the first guys did. They were using a different kind of sampler. About that time was when the Department of Natural Resources wanted to know, how should we be doing mercury? How should we be doing it right? And luckily, there was a link made with the oceanographers. And we brought in an oceanographer to Wisconsin right at the start of this project. He came in, went to that same lake, and he used the Claire Patterson clean techniques. In fact, the investigator that came, Bill Fitzgerald from the University of Connecticut, was a student of Claire Patterson. So it was direct lineage of the godfather of clean techniques. Bill came into northern Wisconsin. He used all Teflon sample bottles. He sampled off of a non-metal boat. He had acid-cleaned Teflon bottles. He made sure that as they were taking the sample, he was moving forward so that he wouldn't be sampling any type of water that the boat had already been on. And what he found out is that the actual concentration in that lake that had been reported at 500 nanograms per liter 8 years earlier, I guess it was, and then it went to 100 nanograms per liter a few years after that, he reported that the concentration was probably a half of a nanogram per liter, or 0.5 nanograms per liter. If you look now, if we go back to northern Wisconsin lakes and resample that, that's about the number that we get, anywhere from 0.2 to 0.5 nanograms per liter. That number has been consistent on a fairly pristine lake that we're in parts of a nanogram per liter. Now, that can range based on the type of lake, but now we're starting to use numbers like that, half a nanogram per liter. That was the initial measurement that got us to try to figure out how is mercury cycling in lakes and what does that have to do with mercury that's in fish? How can something that low now actually bioaccumulate in fish?
One of the things that people often ask me is, well, if the concentrations are so low that your sample containers have more mercury in them to start with than the sample would have, well, how can it actually be unsafe in the environment? And that's one of the very interesting aspects of mercury, and that is even though in water and in air, the concentrations are extremely low, mercury accumulates very rapidly and very efficiently in just specific parts of the ecosystem. Unfortunately, one of those compartments is the food web. And the higher up you go on that food web, the more and more mercury you will find. So whereas water will have one part per trillion of mercury in it, a fish can have a part per million. So that's a 1 million-fold increase in concentration between the water that the fish is swimming in and the fish itself. And at a part per million, mercury concentrations, in fact, are not safe to consume on a regular basis. The bioaccumulation, as we call it, of mercury is one of the highest of any pollutants that we're aware of. Because of that, airways and waterways are seemingly very low in mercury contamination, and yet the fish or the other consumable parts of the ecosystem can, in fact, represent an unsafe exposure path.
Right about that time, the Department of Natural Resources was starting to look at mercury in lakes in northern Wisconsin especially. And they were finding that larger predatory fish, walleyes and musky, larger carnivorous fish, had elevated mercury in them. They had dealt with elevated mercury in fish before, but it was usually in places that there were high levels of contamination. They had seen mercury accumulate in fish in the Wisconsin River, in the Fox River, and into the southern part of Green Bay, places where there were point sources for mercury. Fish are sort of the markers of the state of the lake environment or state of the ocean environment also, in that they do bioaccumulate different types of contaminants. When the State Department of Natural Resources saw that concentrations in some of the fish caught from northern Wisconsin lakes in particular were high and were actually higher than the FDA recommended concentration in flesh of fish, they had to start putting warnings out for consumption. So there are consumption advisories for fish all over the state of Wisconsin. That's still in effect today. But the surprising thing was these advisories were being issued for lakes where there were no industries. There were no industries located on the shores. There were no point sources of mercury. I thought at the time this would be a great project to be involved in, is to try to figure out the mercury mystery in northern Wisconsin. Why were these fish getting such elevated levels of mercury in them?
So my first job was to help start up the mercury laboratory in environmental chemistry, or what was called water chemistry at the time. This would have been 1989, November. We were working on what was called a seepage lake, meaning it had no river input or river output. The only way it could get mercury was from the atmosphere. We knew that mercury dissolves into acidic environments. Sulfate was the main culprit for acid rain, and there's some known relationships between mercury and sulfur. Even the form of mercury that you mine, cinnabar, is mercury sulfide. So there were some connections there, atmospheric-wise.
The next part that was done for the first time in Wisconsin was to take those clean techniques and look at atmospheric precipitation, look at the concentrations in the rain, look at other processes. So here we go with that type of study that Wisconsin is so well known for, and that's the multidisciplinary approach. Let's look at rain. Let's look at the lake. Let's separate out some of the plankton, the phytoplankton. Let's look at the sediments. Let's look at groundwater inflow. Let's look at groundwater outflow. Let's start to put together a mass balance. And if you put a mass balance together and you use these clean techniques, you can start to figure out that the mercury in those pristine lakes was coming in from the rain, that atmospheric deposition was the main source, and then somehow it was getting bioaccumulated up the food chain at some pretty astounding numbers, to go from nanograms per liter to almost, in some cases, a microgram per gram of fish. If you do the math on all of that, you know, you're talking about 10,000 to 100,000 to million-fold increase in concentration. The hallmark of all of that study was that atmospheric deposition is affecting our lakes and affecting it from mercury. We knew that for acid rain back in the earlier days. Why were lakes so acidic? We looked to the atmosphere. But in order to look to the atmosphere for mercury, you had to do it using these new techniques, and you had to look at things cleanly. What we were finding out was that in a lake, which was about a 10-acre lake, average depth of maybe 10, 15 feet, that if you summed up all of the different boxes in the lake, and what I mean by boxes are what is dissolved, what is in the particle phase, what's in fish, what's in plankton, all of those different compartments of a lake, we're finding that in that small lake, the total mercury in that entire lake was a half a gram. And what was really interesting about that is that if you summed everything up and got a half a gram of mercury in the entire lake, at the same time, there were sneaker companies that were making these light-up sneakers that kids would run around and the lights would go back and forth. They would light up. And why would they light up? Because there was a little ball of mercury in there. It was tripping the switch. So we were looking at a half a gram of mercury just in this lake, and kids were running around with 2-3 grams of mercury in their shoes. When someone called the company about that use of mercury, the first response back was, "Oh, it's only a gram or two per shoe." And that was pretty interesting, because that was more than what was in our entire lake. Now, there are some caveats in all of that. The mercury that comes out of the shoe isn't exactly the form of mercury that's in the fish that's swimming in the lake, but everything contributes. The mercury that's in the fish in lakes is methylmercury. We had to go additional steps, and many other studies were going on using these additional steps, looking at what controlled that formation of methylmercury, the form that actually bioaccumulates up the food web.
This podcast was produced by Chris Bocast, that's me, for the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute, with funding provided by the United States Geological Survey. The scientists you heard were Anders Andreyan, David Krabenhoff, Jim Hurley, and Chris Babiars. This podcast is public domain. Thanks for listening.